Man, were you gonna do something for Kevin? We try to set our display.
It's up to you. Okay. I think we're gonna start. Looks like we have a few people online, but I think first and foremost, the most important order of business. One, I do want to welcome our new commissioners here, and we'll get to you all soon. But we have a commissioner who has been with us since the beginning of the Commission on Equitable Housing and Development. So we did want to give Mary Ann a huge thank you. And we have cake here.
That's for it.
And so just really want to say thank you. I know as a volunteer, giving countless hours over the past 5 years is not easy. And so really, really appreciate it. And glad you could come. Right. And so please, there is a cake back there. We should probably cut into the cake so people don't feel shy. And I'll turn it over to Jay. Should we introduce new folks?
Really want cake, but I mean, still just have a
priority. Sorry.
Any comment?
Should I go ahead and call the meeting to order? Or do you think that? Okay. So I would like to call this meeting to order. The Commission on Equitable Housing and Development meeting is now commenced. It is September 4th at 4:09 p.m. This is a hybrid meeting. If you are joining us virtually, we ask that you mute yourselves until called upon to speak to avoid feedback and background noise. If you called in using your phone to unmute to speak, dial *6 and only use the chat function to request to speak. Also, to comply with the state open meeting law, attendance and votes will be done by way of roll call using audio. So I would like to, at this point, call the roll. Maggie Amato-Tellez.
Present.
Mindy Bernstein. I know Mindy is with us. Vicky Cusino. Do we have any commission members online?
Yes, we have Marcos and Mike online.
Okay.
Let me see if anyone else.
Logan Havens.
Here.
Serena Warake. She's here. Lori Mazurbo. Ann Miski.
Present.
Robert Ojeda.
Here.
Tisha Tallman is not here. Alan Zolot.
Here.
Jim Toefel is on his way. Ray Winch.
Here.
Kenny Wong.
Here.
And Jay Young, that is me. Ex officio members, Ann Janeka.
Here.
Corin Manning.
Present.
Marcos Ismail.
Present.
And Mike Edmonds. I see Mike online there.
He might be looking for headphones. He said the volume might be a little low for him.
Okay. Well, with that, we have quorum, and I would like to welcome our two new members, Logan Havens and Ann Miski. Welcome to the commission. Glad to have you all here. And with that, let's see, what else do I need to do? With that, I would like to approve the August meeting minutes. Have folks had a chance to review the meeting minutes? And if so, are there any changes? And if there are no changes, I will entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
I do not have the minutes in your packets, but I do have two extra just in case, but they were in your digital packets, I assumed.
No, thank you. Yeah, the two are.
Yes, yeah, and the.
Move that approved.
Do I have a second?
Second.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Okay, we have approved the August meeting minutes. Thank you. So I'm going to take a minute to review the agenda. I'll take a minute to review the agenda. So what we are going to do today is dive into the recommendations that we have come up with in our subcommittees. But the main news is that Brian Manwaring, who is the facilitator who we've been working with, came down with COVID. So obviously he is not here. And what I would like to do, if it's okay with everybody, is forge ahead on our own, even though we won't have a facilitator, and just see how it goes. If we feel like, you know, we can't get through it, or, you know, we want to have facilitation next meeting, we can do that. Or the other option is we could just not deal with that today, wait for the facilitator for the next meeting, and just spend more time on the things that are on the agenda already, and then, you know, obviously leave early if we get done
so
early.
I'm not clear, what part was the facilitator going to work on that we're going to skip?
Really diving into the recommendations that we came up with in our
subcommittee. For the housing trust fund.
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
I would like to just, like, go through and see how we do and kind of take it from there. Obviously, you know, we can get facilitation for next time. So does that seem okay for everyone? Opposition in that? Okay. So we will basically do what we have planned to do today. The other thing, and Rachel, remind me, do I need to get approval to move the agenda around, or?
Yeah, I think we just need to, oh, we don't? Okay.
All right, good. Chair's discretion.
Okay, so if you look at the agenda, we're going to redo the order a little bit. So what I would like to do is, after the call to the audience, go to discussing the Housing Trust Fund recommendation next. Then after that, discuss the Middle Housing Code amendments. And then after that, identify the approach to present recommendations to Mayor and Council. And then go to presenting and discussing our action plans and then the rest of the agenda after that. So if there's no objection, that is what I would like to do today for our event. Any questions about the agenda? I know that was a lot and we're kind of changing things up, but any questions before we move on? Okay. With that, I would like to move to the next agenda item, which is the call to the audience. And the call to the audience is no more than 3 minutes per person. And we're going to 10 minutes total if there are folks that would like to speak. All speakers must share their name to be recorded in the meeting minutes. And please remember, the call to the audience may not result in a discussion of members of the commission. No legal action may take place during the call to the audience, and speakers may not be disruptive. CEHD members may only respond to criticism and request that items be placed on a future agenda for discussion, and members of the audience may still participate on agenda items as per the bylaws of CEHD. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak?
No hands are raised.
I would like to. I'm in the audience now, right?
Yeah.
I guess.
Sure.
All right. Well, that wouldn't. Did you vote?
No.
Then you're retired. So I just wanted to thank you for inviting me to come and for the new members. The first few years, actually, the commission actually got a hell of a lot of work done. And with the support of Housing and Development, who implemented a lot of that and got us in front of Mayor and Council and were able to support and put into action a lot of the suggestions we made and the considerations, you know, that we wanted. I think I have seen that last 5 years a huge turnaround with policies and codes and willingness on the part of the city to, you know, make changes for everything that this committee, you know, has put forth. But it couldn't be done without Anne and her department. It absolutely cannot. And I think the about face that department has done in the last few years is amazing. So there's, you know, should be a lot of applaud in anybody working on this commission. and coming out of this commission, you know, should know that we have a friend and a friendly relationship with the city of Tucson and mayor and council. And I also just, you know, I don't, a lot of people who are on this commission are doing a lot of work quietly in the background that, you know, need to be, I think, it needs to be known, because that kind of commitment is coming to this commission. For instance, I don't know if any of you know that Jim Toefel has been working with the Republican congressman from Nebraska to put forth the Housing Supply Act, which is going to reduce costs and take out antiquated requirements that are costing a lot of money to put affordable housing forth. And that has passed the Housing Committee. So, you know, and we have people like Jay, who is making sure, you know, the best that he can in politicking regarding keeping, you know, discrimination at bay under this administration, and also, you know, that fair housing still exists, you know, for forever. Quietly just doing that in the background and working with, you know, the state of Arizona, like Ray is doing, you know, in her work with the unfairness that are facing people who are living in mobile home parks. I think that is just a sample of what folks on this commission do. Kenny, of course, with the reports and the studies and the housing and water reports. It's just absolutely amazing stuff. So you're all awesome. And I just felt intimidated most of the time, but was really happy to be part of this commission and to actually see change happen from a commission. So whatever the Pima County Commission has to say about us not being effective, they're full of beans, and they just don't see it, and that's unfortunate. But so thank you. That's all I have to say.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mary.
Was that 3 minutes?
It doesn't matter. Anybody else in the audience that would like to speak?
No one's raising their hand in the audience.
Okay. Hearing none, we can move on to the next agenda item, which is to discuss the Housing Trust Fund recommendation. And I think you all have that in your packet. And if I'm not mistaken, Anne, are you going to set that up?
I'm happy to give sort of a HCD overview. I'll say one, thank you, thank you, thank you. You know, I know it's not easy to be like, hey, Mayor and Council, ask you all to decide how to recommend $320,000+ of funding in a short amount of time. And so I do really appreciate the working group. Matt met several times over the past couple months, and so thank you. One update, I will be presenting, hopefully together with Jay, the second meeting in September to Mayor and Council. Anyone is welcome to come. Anyone's welcome to tune in, but your recommendations will be at the study session that September 23rd in the afternoon at Mayor and Council. I read this, and I would love you all to go through them, but I did want to just give a couple thoughts on the folks who administer these things. So the House program, I will say, because I have another funding source, my proposal there in talking to our Housing First program and Councilmember Cunningham, who's really spearheading this pilot, I am comfortable in actually how it's going to work on September 23rd. We're going to have your recommendations, and then the next item is going to be the Councilmember Cunningham House pilot item, so they'll be back to back since they sort of correlate. I'm comfortable saying that the HPD Housing First program can administer the program in terms of it's really designed to help people get out of shelter. So they're already working with a lot of these folks. And so helping them get set up into their new places and working with the landlords to make sure that's covered. And I'm okay using other HCD funding to help administer that. Where I think it gets a little trickier is the $150,000 for emergency rental assistance. The way we do our emergency rental assistance programs now, the payment will often go through an external vendor to help us so that it's quicker. And Allison can jump in here if I'm saying anything that's not correct. But we do have to pay administrative costs for that, and I don't have a funding source for that. And so we were thinking that based on the amount of money, that's about $35,000 to help administer and make sure everything's tracked and everything's good. And so I did want to point that out. I know there was the remaining $95,000. So if a portion of that remaining $95,000 can go to administration, that would keep the whole $150,000 for emergency rental assistance. Up to you. It's your, I mean, the other alternative would be, I would recommend to Mayor and Council a portion of that $150,000 be taken out for administrative costs because we need to pay people to do these programs. And I don't have another funding source for that one. So I wanted to give that perspective as you go through and discuss them. Unfortunately, right now, the city's budget and HCD's budget is as uncertain as it's ever been. And so really trying to figure out when we can commit administrative costs and when we can't. And here's an example where one, I feel like we can make it work. One, I feel like we need additional funding to make sure that's done well.
I'll just add and was sort of correct in the due diligence we've done in terms of the admin costs to administer the eviction prevention funding. I would just, with the caveat that sort of any, that the increases in funding for that program, it's basically a percentage cost, right? So we pay a certain percentage based on the amount that goes out to that third party. And so, you know, say we were to put $200,000 in that pot, we would sort of need a corresponding amount for administrative costs, essentially 23%.
Wow. I'm hoping somebody from the committee can kind of walk through the recommendations and how you got there, but wanted to give that caveat up front.
I have a question if I can ask you.
Sure.
If there is $150,000 of rental assistance available that's eventually approved, how, we're very vague on how that gets distributed, you know, what the criteria is, who gets it. It seems the smallish amount is not going to last very long, or unless it's like, you know, $500 per person or something, you know, it's most people's back rent's going to be several thousand.
Yeah.
So it can get used up really fast. So I just wonder what your thought is on.
Yeah. And I think there's a few different options there. In terms of Tucson People Collaboration to End Homelessness, people may be familiar with the process that they use. I do think we are thinking something similar to that, where case managers from any organization in the community can say, we know this person's behind, really trying to help get them caught up. Separately, individuals can apply themselves.
So the way the TPCH funds have been administered, and I think what's envisioned in Kat's presentation for this, is that it would be similar where case managers would apply, and those that don't have a case manager ideally would go through the 311 system and kind of be handled through our community safety, health, and wellness team. And so that would kind of be that case management touch for them.
And so any case manager, any organization from any case manager can apply and describe the circumstances. There's a maximum amount, from my understanding, and it's tracked in terms of the goal here is to really be able to help folks that do have a funding to sustain themselves, but really need to get caught up. But the goal is hopefully that they won't be evicted 3 months from now instead of now.
So the use of the rental assistance won't be available if you don't have a way to keep paying your rent.
That's my understanding in terms of
how. That's a common thing. I just want to understand that.
Yeah. And I think this is open for discussion. If you feel like there are aspects right now that aren't working that should be built into this particular path.
Is there anyone else that has funds for a rental right now?
I think there's a lot of different groups. I know Pima Council on Aging has money right now, actually. Trevor, sorry, you're here. You
they do have
we were just discussing this at TPCH, that if they're over 60, send them to PCOA.
Come to us for that. But the number is increasing as well for us. So that pot is getting smaller and smaller.
What we're seeing a lot is even Mortgage Depot. And a lot of people call and say, do you have monetary assistance? And we're like, no. But, you know, we're trying to get in for the counseling. But I'm wondering, like, one guy came and he's 8 months behind. And I'm like, yikes, you know, you're a little late. But everyone remembers the HAP program from right at COVID. I'm just wondering, because those people are also facing homelessness, right? They get evicted or foreclosed on.
My answer to your question about rental assistance is it runs hot and cold. There are agencies that have it and then they don't, and agencies that don't have it and they do, like Primavera has money right now, I think. Interfaith Community Services did in May. I recently heard they don't have it now. GFCS has some, I think they may still.
Yeah.
It's just all these different outfits. And that's one of the challenges, because how do people know who to call and what to do? And it's really difficult. And my answer is when I talk to them, it's just call everybody. Don't call one people and wait for a return call. Call.
It'd be nice to have a, I don't know, current list.
Yeah.
And everybody just, next week it'll be different.
Yeah, that's true.
But
yeah.
This conversation's timely in terms of later agenda items. And I did see a recommendation specifically related to this topic. And before I forget, my understanding, in addition to PCOA, our family services currently has funding for youth, so 18 to 24. And so just that is what we were told yesterday in terms of what's out there right now.
Just to mention about foreclosures, is sort of off topic, but Chapter 13 bankers, you can't help if you can afford to do what's required of.
Right.
I guess I was curious, like, you know, for the windows when rental assistance is available, like, what has that been typically, like, months or weeks or 10 days?
I'm not sure if you understand what you mean.
Like, you know, you're saying, like, groups have funding, they don't. So what's the infusion that, you know?
I think they run out of money. You know, they have unlimited resources. $150,000 might be here. That's going to get used up.
What are you talking about, like, over months or like weeks?
Yes,
months. In our case, it's months.
Yeah. And also the criteria is different, like, you know, the 60 or the youth or whatever, but also how much they'll help with. I think that is a really good subject to talk about in the future about, I don't know, streamlining that, maybe standardizing it. I know it's... not my money, but it would be easier to refer people.
Months ago, TES had money, maybe a year ago, and their rules are you had to have minor children or be over age 65. If you didn't have that, you weren't eligible for it, and it was a one-time deal. If you got it once in your life, you never get it again.
I guess what I'm asking about, too, is, like, what are, like, groups offering this assistance, like, doing to smooth over time, like, some of the assistance that's available? So, you know, there's both the timeliness, but also making sure that there is some resource that's available.
Well, I'm just wondering, you know, getting back to the recommendations, you know, I wonder if the eviction prevention recommendation, you know, we could think about having more language in there, potentially, I think is what you were saying, and that, like, kind of defines how that could work, maybe, or...
I mean, these are your recommendations.
Right,
so you,
right.
You know, I think that you feel strong.
What I'd like to do is I can just kind of review this briefly, and those of you that were part of these discussions as well, please help me out, but just to kind of frame the discussion. You know, we had, how many times did we meet?
Three. Twice, it might have been three.
Yeah, and had some pretty deep conversations about, you know, how to get this money out the door and what we wanted to do, and obviously... you know, there are three bullet points, as Anne mentioned, eviction prevention, the house program, and then the third bullet is, you know, money for community-led projects that are innovative in nature and community-based and focused, I believe. And, you know, I think what we talked about in the in the discussion as well with this $95,000 was, you know, having questions about, you know, would there need to be money for administration and kind of, you know, how all of that would play out. So I feel like, for me at least, you know, the kind of information that we've gotten from Anne and HCD, I don't know what the group thinks, but, you know, could potentially change these a little bit. But so I don't know, what else do we need to kind of put on the table regarding these recommendations from the group?
So, I mean, my pet project isn't on here, which is to try to start a pilot project to do you have tenants' right to counsel. So if you get sued for eviction, you get a lawyer. There's not enough money here to do that, but we have had the notion that we could start a pilot project and maybe fund for a couple of years, maybe one lawyer or two lawyers doing that. It wouldn't cover everybody. That wasn't in the recommendations. I think it's still an important thing, and I would still like to see it happen. And that's one question I have for you, Anna, or I don't know who can answer this. Once this money is used up, is it going to be replenished? Is there any motivation to continue having this money come in from some source, or what?
I think the end of this document does a good job of suggesting to mayor and council that they consider looking at sustainable sources to bring in. That would be a mayor council decision. So I think as a body, you know, feel free to recommend what you think makes sense. But I do think that there was some language to that
yeah.
I noticed.
Right, we need that. I mean, it's such a smallish amount of money that you know, I mean, doing this is good. It's good to use the money to help people. That's what we want to do. But more needs to be done. And I'm mindful of what you said earlier is that the city's budget is difficult, so there's no money for it. I don't know where it would come from. And I don't pretend to know, but I just am saying it'd be important to do that. And again, get back to tenants' rights to counsel. It's something that needs to happen. It's happening across the country in various jurisdictions. It's a forward-looking thing. If we get that, Tucson will be on the edge of doing the right thing. It makes such a huge difference. You know, and the topic is eviction prevention. That's the first bullet point here. And this prevents evictions. Having a lawyer prevents evictions. Not having a lawyer means you're going to be evicted. You just get railroaded. It's just really awful. That what happens because the you know the lawyer and the judge knows what's going on, the tenant doesn't, and they're out. And if there's a lawyer there, it's going to be a different deal. And it's really important to do this. And there's no funding for it, certainly not here, and the recommendation doesn't include it. But I think I would like to see something go to mayor and council to make this part of the recommendation, and maybe even like a minority report. I could do a minority report. Nobody wants to do this apparently. I would be happy to do that. So I'd like to have them look at it and say, yeah, that's something we can consider. Phoenix might do it. Phoenix commissioned a study. It's just something we should look at. I think it's important. I have all kinds of ideas why it's important.
Yeah, one of the things, and one of your first questions was about the servicing fee and whether to include it or have it outside. I would say include it in this and have it marked that there's a percentage service fee and then change the number of how many people are benefited by this. Because if we say this is the dollar amount, this is the servicing fee, that means we can help this many people. And this is the largest thing we can do to lower the cost. Once they're out of the system, the dollar amount gets so much higher to bring them back. I think that helps us say like, okay, let's buy more pot to help more people, or like helps justify it, and then it also helps focus on the actual cost rather than trying to find like a secondary, like secret fund or like an abstract fund. I'd say like included in the price.
In for that recommendation, you're saying including it in the $150,000.
Yeah, I would say $150,000. Let's say it ends up being $120,000 with $30,000 servicing fee to ensure the payments go out, just so it's all transparent and visible for all the departments to see. And then it modifies this from 75 people to, let's say, 60 people being able to be kept in housing. And then I think that keeps the numbers more visible. And then we say, like, we desperately need more of this funding. Because then if you find $30,000, then that also gets wrapped into this and we get 20% of that goes to board servicing. I think it keeps it more easy to understand.
I think that on your point there, Alan, about the right to counsel, I think we've talked about it in the, I think we've talked about this large group meeting. We might have only talked about the MH task force, that Pima County EELS is there, but that in the eviction notice that the judge has blocked including Pima County EELS' number on the eviction notice and requiring that to be on the eviction notice. To me, that's something too, that's a no cost shift of a lot of people only get the EELS number when they're evicted in court. That's when the judge gives them the number.
So I learned about a week ago from Andy Flagg that, that they have a way of getting the every eviction filing from the court, and they have a mail merge, and they send a postcard to everybody who's got an eviction filed against them, not necessarily even served, and says, we're EELS and we can help you. So everybody's told about EELS apparently right at the beginning. It's late in the game because the hearing is going to be, you know, if we put that in the mail, they're going to get it maybe the day of the hearing. So, but anyway, that is what's going on.
I say that delay to me is actually a big deal, right?
And Andy said they get 27 calls a day, which, you know, there's thousands of eviction filings, you know, maybe a month, but maybe 500 a month, and 27 a day is just a fraction.
I don't know what power this group has. I think in that, because it's not like mayor council's decision to require that number be put on there. But I do think that is a low barrier, low cost way of having it really clear, requiring on the eviction paperwork that it says you have the right to free legal services if you income qualified. And here's the number to call.
Yeah, and then EELS would need more funding if they're going to get more people. And so and that's another way of approaching their right to counsel thing is to pump up EELS so they can actually do that. Mm-hmm. To get the court to do something, have the city tell them to do something, I don't see that the court's going to do that. But I think the city can make a recommendation and I think the court would have to consider it. But I don't know if there's a way to force it that I know of.
So I would like to get back to what we need to do with this recommendation. I mean, having been part of the group that, you know, came up with these, I guess to me, it feels like the new information changes this up a little bit. And I know that we need to, you know, get something out as soon as possible. But at this point, I'm a little bit skeptical that, you know, this is quite ready to go. I mean, you know, as much as, and I don't know, did you mention the, like, what the process would be for that third bullet point of, you know, if there were to be, you know, community-led projects that were, you know, approved or whatever, there would need to be some sort of process, correct? And that would go through HCD or, like, what would that?
I mean, I'm interested in hearing the thought there. This is me just feeling a lot of pressure with a lot of little funding these days. I am a little worried we do our PCHIP process every 2 years. We are not on the cycle for PCHIP, so we won't be doing that this year. And so for folks that don't know, that's our nonprofit grant making. There's some federal funding, but there is general fund money where you can propose different types of housing. So I don't know, I'm open to ideas, but I am a little nervous in terms of the low dollar amount and the work it might take to try to put that out. And at the same time, also want to be open to, if there are good ideas that can come out of a small amount of money, open to that too. But it does concern me from the administrative standpoint. I mean, in it, this money's been sitting there a while. Theoretically, it could be added to the next PCHIP round, which is not going to be until, you know, a year from now.
Just to chime in, you know, like with the administrative costs, like to me, it makes sense to kind of to pull it from that. So the emergency rental assistance, to your first point, would be the $450,000. And then, you know, kind of in the working group advocating for the community-led projects, I'm aware the PCHIP process, you know, it is pretty involved, a lot of documentation. So it does meet groups that have the capacity, their needs, to write the application once, you know, measure and track it. And so, you know, I guess I'm interested in this being, since it's more flexible funding, something a little lower barrier, and opening the door for different providers, you know, different community groups, mutual aid support, that are just working in really different ways and connected with people that, that are still using services and have need, to be able to support those types of groups more as insurance. So, you know, I know it's still probably it still has to have a process, but maybe something a little more accessible that you it doesn't have to be a huge administrative burden, hopefully, but something that folks can feel like, okay, we can try something different, pilot something.
I was going to say, I tend to agree. I think that the eviction prevention, the 150, that's not a lot of money already. And we know that prevention is definitely the way to go. The costs for prevention are so much lower than the costs for when somebody is evicted. So I like the idea. And to your point, Anne, about, you know, it's not a lot of money for innovation, but I think there's some really interesting things you could do with small pockets of money, or sort of innovation starter funds. And what I think would be really interesting is if you could get some private funders, you know, have some money to get people started on some innovation, and then see if you can bring in some other folks in the community, private funders, who might then look at some of those things. But this is almost a starter fund, a starter innovation fund for a few thousand dollars to help people. But I tend to like the idea of using some of your admin dollars out of that 95 and keeping the 150 for prevention, because to me, that prevention dollar is so crucial.
I apologize for being late. What did I miss? What was the issue?
$5,000 somewhere. to summarize the same point.
Oh, so there needs to be, we need to have $35,000
to administer the rental assistance program. It's either got to come out of 150 or have another source.
Oh, okay. So we're, that's the debate. So we take it out of the first item or the third item? Or the second.
About what the minimum requirements are for what that kind of process would look like.
And I think there's some flexibility, as Kenny mentioned, it is a flexible funding source. That said, it's been held in a city, like it's actually arguably public money, which is why the attorney's office said we can do it for two. But given it does go through the city, I think there just needs to be a defensible way that we're giving money and showing what we're doing for that money. But I think there's some flexibility there. And I think for purposes of the second meeting in September, that doesn't have to be fully fleshed out. And I think this commission can recommend what that is. And, you know, it's possible you could recommend people submit up to $5,000, $10,000 of ideas, and they can come present here and you can sort of figure it out. There's, I think there's options there. That doesn't have to be figured out. But I think given the timeline on some of these other things, I have to say the commission's recommending these funding in these pots, but that third pot, I think more information can come. And it's possible mayor and council are the ultimate decider here, so they may take the recommendations and juju them a little bit.
Is there a possibility of maybe partnering with nonprofits, especially like HUD-approved housing counseling agencies who are already doing some of the work by the counseling? I don't know. I'm just thinking partnering, giving it up. Like, for instance, you know, 75 is not a lot of people, but obviously I wouldn't take them all on, but I could perhaps take on a few.
I think,
and I know that would be a kind of a logistical nightmare.
Exactly. And I think the number of organizations who submitted for emergency rental assistance in the PCHIP round makes me hesitant to say, you know, if we were to divvy up every nonprofit. And so I like the idea of it being administered where anyone can submit to the portal, anyone they're working with.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly not prioritized for any one agency or any one person.
Wasn't CIC doing something like that in the day?
So while CIC had the large emergency rental assistance program, which I miss so much, it was the COVID program that we're talking millions and millions of dollars. But CIC is the fiscal agent for Tucson Pima collaboration to end homelessness. Okay. I think we're thinking similar there. One portal, one application, any nonprofit or individual going through 311 in Cashew can submit for funding.
So I know we have a deadline. We want to present this to mayor and council.
We need to present
a couple of weeks, and we're not going to have another commission meeting before that mayor and council meeting. The big debate we were having in the working group is, do we put more of the money in fewer categories so we have a bigger impact in those categories, or do we try to spread it out? And this is where we landed. But given we need to put 35,000, I guess my feeling is we just take the 35,000 out of the third item. And so that would leave 60,000 remaining for the community-led projects. That would give us the full 150 for eviction prevention and rental assistance. And then it would allow us to kind of get kickstarted the house program. So is that kind of what you're thinking as well? Is that where you're? I know that you can't.
That is one of the options. The other option is it comes from 150.
Yeah, I guess my preference would be to keep as much into the rental assistance as possible.
I mean, I think after hearing all this, I would probably go even farther and say I would not do number three, and I would put the 95,000 up to the eviction prevention. As much as I love the idea of the community-led projects, I think that's important, but also knowing that there is the PCHIP process, that is part. And then I think the other thing we could potentially do is we could look more into PCHIP and like what the requirements are, and we could recommend that, you know, there be more of a category or more of a attention paid to innovative projects in the PCHIP process as well. So I just feel like, again, with the idea that, you know, eviction prevention, we know that that works and keeps people off the streets.
Yeah.
And 60,000 is such a small amount, but there's not a real process in place. It just seems like a real heavy lift for not much bang for the buck at this point, as much as it pains me to say, I think we should not do number three at this point. So if the group wants to keep the third one and, you know, just reduce the funds, I'd be fine with that too. But I just wanted to say that. It's kind of where
I understand the short-term impact of the 75 households, maybe more if you add the other amount. But what is the impact of, you know, community-led projects beyond the short term? And so just because it's such a small amount of money, I'm just curious, being new to the group, you know, why was this one here, the third bullet mm-hmm. point? And what is the impact of that beyond the short term? Because, I mean, it's almost appalling that it's so small.
Would you be recommending then actually increasing the amount of money in that third one?
Well, at least not impacting the 95, just mm-hmm. because, but not knowing exactly mm-hmm. what do we mean by that? What is the impact of that work and beyond the short term?
Right.
Can I ask a clarifying question that I'm not sure about with the eviction prevention? Is it only rental assistance mm-hmm. or can it be used for other things? So, for example, a lot of the prevention work I've done in the past, a person comes and says, my car broke down. I have a choice of paying for my car to be prepared if I go to work or paying my rent. So, in fact, we've used dollars, often much smaller dollars than rental payments, to help the person get over that financial crisis so they can keep paying their rent. So I'm curious about that, kids, because now we're getting into real complexity.
And the way it is administered today, I know this through a long series of incidents, it is more flexible. It is about keeping people housed. And so it's up to a certain amount per household that will result in keeping them housed loosely. Yeah.
That's great. Thank you.
And with that, you mentioned that agencies can refer to TPCH for that. Do you know if what the requirements are for someone to be a case manager, like they have to be in the HMIS database, or can it be like mutual aid groups too?
Imagine that, yes, it could be sort of interpreted more broadly, right? I think the general idea that we've heard is that we want someone to have some of that support to make sure that that we're not applying over and over and over again, that there's kind of a longer term plan for kind of using those funds to help establish stability. But yeah, I think that can be sort of loosely interpreted the direction.
Maybe I would be more comfortable with like that if we were to take the money out of the 95,000 and have it go towards the rental assistance, is doing that in a way then that's including some of the community-based groups, and including like one of the next points on the agenda, right, is about how we know about who has funding and those kinds of things, and like really working with like quote unquote caseworkers, maybe they would call themselves a caseworker, maybe they wouldn't, about how the application process works, and just to have it be as low barrier as possible. I know I give out numbers all the time and people almost never get the rental assistance funds when they're calling themselves. And if there were, yeah, a process that felt like people weren't running around in circles trying to get the funding.
I'll just add a couple things based on the conversation I'm hearing. One is that, right, I think part of the ultimate goal, you know, kind of TPCH and some of the rental assistance and eviction prevention work they've been doing are really seeing the benefit of kind of that centralized system. We've been talking about some of the like various agencies that have funding, and there's definitely a desire to kind of centralize, and I think funding can help catalyze maybe a larger community conversation about how do we kind of streamline the resources there. So that's one sort of background context that, you know, I think, putting some is and starting to have that conversation is, I think, one of the things I'm taking away from this conversation. And then another is just a reminder of what's in the recommendation from the work group. It also includes sort of four categories that they would like the housing trust fund to be used more broadly. And so that includes both the kind of rental support as well as home ownership support, housing development support, and then those kind of innovative community-led projects. And so obviously we can't fund something in all four of those categories right now. You know, we could spend all the money on one housing development. But just that sort of a reminder of thinking about the idea of the trust fund being a longer term initiative as well, if given funding.
Is there any way, I know that we were at a meeting with the University of Arizona and they're really wanting to focus on housing, on homelessness prevention. And so I'm curious if some of that money could be used to really help create, that we talked about creating systems that were more coordinated with agencies. Is there a possibility of using some of this money to say, go to someone like the U of A to say, could you work on, doesn't have to be them, but just as an example, of building a coordinated prevention system. And to your point about part of that could be training for people, I don't know, so that it is a long-term result for some money, which is what we're looking for in that last bucket. But it really is around it is sort of around number one, but to create a more coordinated system.
Well, and then, you know, going to, the main thing that we were going to do today, talking about the action plans around homelessness, at least the number one thing from our subcommittee is the lack of a coordinated system, and that needs to be kind of top of the list, I think. So it's definitely floating around in a lot of different places, I think, that we're kind of working in.
And I would say, I think, having a more coordinated system, I know that's something TPCH is working on and trying to be more inclusive, so it's not just TPCH-funded agencies. I think with this little amount of money, I'd be leery to like pick, especially U of A sort of being not as engaged in these conversations.
But there are researchers at the U of A who have separate philanthropic funding that be doing some of this similar evaluation and system mapping work. So there's like cross purposes for, again, kind of putting foot in the door as the HD with the Housing Trust Fund towards that goal, joint goal.
I still wanted to advocate for the, at least some of that funding to be for the innovation or community type projects. And then as you're talking to the university now, at my previous institution, students started a shelter for partnering with a local faith-based organization. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that's going to reach people that, you know, are kind of are systems that do work that just don't speak to, you know, the ways that people are connected very differently or where they'll seek out help, right? And where they feel comfortable for receiving it. So, you know, that could be an example of, okay, if there's a little bit of funding, you know, it could spark that idea, catalyze, draw additional funding, private sources, whatever. It just encouraged some entrepreneurship to around meeting, offering some different solutions. So that, again, it's just like, you know, it's flexible funding. You know, it is, you know, from the community. And I think there's a lot of like trust building that needs to be done around housing issues too. And I feel like it could go and really make a really large impact. If we are saying, hey, if we're setting aside some funding, you know, come with ideas.
Okay, so I mean, I'm kind of sitting with Jay's camp. I would prefer to see the money all put under emergency rental assistance, but in the interest of building consensus, the group, I think we need to kind of figure out how to bring this to closure. And I want to go back to the thing that I first said, which was, you know, there's obviously a desire to keep some money in here for community-led projects. So my recommendation, or I guess what I'd like to propose, is that we accept these recommendations from the Housing Trust Fund Work Group, with the exception of $35,000 will be moved from the last item into administration. That's the motion I'd like to make.
Can I ask a question about the house program? You said there was more funding for that too. They asked for $100,000. We thought that the Ward 2 could probably come up with $25,000. Are there any other funding sources for that? Wondering if that's another place where money could be moved from, or if that's...
So the only other money I'm comfortable at this point is helping the money, the Housing First staffing costs to help support the family and get them moved in. I am committing, which case management costs too. And so I'm not aware of any other for the initial $100,000 pilot.
Great, thank you.
Yeah.
So it needs to be a second or a motion, guys.
I'll second.
Thank you.
All those in favor?
Wait, is there any more discussion? Or
can I ask for some discussion?
Okay, any more discussion?
I would just like to again say I would like to include something from me, if that's the only person going to do it, to suggest that having a tax right to council would be something the city should be examining, whether this is the time to do it or not, whether this money is the money we can use for it. I want the opportunity to do that.
Would that be under these 4 points here, that future things for the Housing Trust?
I just feel like there's an opportunity here to let the mayor and council know this is something they should do.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to take that opportunity.
Yeah,
I think we could say, like, yes, you could argue it fits into one of these four categories, but I think we could explicitly say one of the discussions the work group discussed was this is important, but given the limited money, it didn't rise to the top. So
mm-hmm.
I'm comfortable adding in that language / presenting that to Mayor Council.
I'm interested in maybe some stronger language about the permanent source of funding. Yeah. Not it would be good, but we really want to see that.
Yeah, or it's necessary. It's probably then it would be good. Yeah.
How do you feel about that, using the 35 from
community? I don't support that. I think it's a good, again, the funding is needed in rental assistance.
Mm-hmm.
So
I wonder if it wouldn't be a bad idea to just have the one motion on the table. I think it was just about moving the money around, and then we could potentially have another motion to about the language and about the tenant's right to counsel going into the recommendation as well, right? So that it's a little more clean.
Okay, so you want me to amend my motion?
I was actually thinking we would just keep the motion as is. It's got a second, we vote on it, and then if we want to add more stuff like you guys were talking about, have that be another, maybe one more motion or two motions.
I thought his motion was to approve the plan with that adjustment, but you're doing like a two-stage thing. So the first thing is approve the adjustment and then approve the plan. So is the motion to approve the adjustment then?
Well, I mean, I guess we amend this and then another motion can amend it again, right? I mean, no, this is,
yeah. Or we could just amend the motion with adding the language.
Okay.
I think especially if there's that flexibility where people who are not part of organizations that are not part of the HMIS system would be able to make referrals. I think we're getting some of that community base in by making that transfer, and that to me would serve some of that purpose. I would support that.
Okay, so what do we do from here from a process standpoint? I don't know.
I'd like to hear the motion.
So we restate the motion. We need to write it down. So the motion is to approve the recommendations coming out in the Housing Trust Fund work group, with the exception of $35,000 will be moved from the third category of community-led projects to administrative costs. So the third category was about $60,000. And then adding language to recommend, make sure I say this right, the mayor and council, how should I say this? We'll look into right to council for tenant eviction.
The tenant's right to council is an important concept, and the mayor and council should consider that project. Comes to mind, projects the right word, to implement in the near future because it directly impacts eviction prevention.
Okay, so basically the amendment is that mayor and council consider tenants' right to council for future funding sources.
And then wasn't another part of it that Kenny was saying that the language about long-term support should be more forceful or stronger in some way? I don't know how to
put all of this in motion.
I think it's helpful direction for me, and I want to make sure I know Ray had one, but any housing support organization that they don't have to be part of HMIS to apply for them.
And then we particularly encourage mutual aid organizations and community-based groups to be able to be referrals there and have the process be as low barrier as possible.
So do we have the motion?
With all this one.
Do we have a second?
Yes.
I'll second.
You're good with that? You're good with the amendment?
I'm good with
All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. All right, the motion passes.
Should we ask if anyone's opposed?
Does anybody oppose?
Is anybody opposed?
No.
I was going to ask for the motion to be repeated because I'm totally confused. You totally lost me. So I think you have to put me down as abstaining. I did not vote.
Sorry about that, Vicky. I did not.
It would have been really helpful to have the actual motion repeated.
I can try to repeat it again.
Well, it's a little late for that. You already voted.
That's true. Sorry about that, Vicky. I did not know that you were on the screen and I was not alerted. So moving on to the next agenda item, discuss middle housing code amendments. I believe, Corin, have you talked about that?
I'm happy to. And also Amanda Smith of PSD is online as well.
And before you get started, I will just say again, a little bit of context. We've basically been asked as a commission to consider supporting these middle housing code amendments because they align with a lot of the things that we're concerned about and have been working on. It's obviously a little bit quick, but I was comfortable bringing this forward because of how well I think it aligns with basically what we've been working on up to this point. So that's where we're coming from here. This is about approving a letter to support these code amendments.
Sure. So as you guys might be aware, there was a House bill passed actually a year ago in the state legislature. So 2024 legislative session, it was passed by the state legislature to require that jurisdictions of 75,000 or more allow middle housing within a mile of their downtown central business districts. And middle housing is defined as duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes, and townhouses. So really that middle scale of development, and it's also intended to be in the middle of the range in terms of cost, affordability, and where our market is for housing. So it really is intended to meet more of the need for market rate affordable housing. These units are very difficult to build truly, you know, with subsidy as affordable units that would be rent regulated or regulated for homeowners, but it's trying to meet a missing segment of our market for housing. So we have done a bit of community engagement. We had a lot of great feedback over the past few months from residents. And really what we heard was to go beyond the minimum of state regulations and look at really where this makes sense in Tucson. So we've done a lot of analysis about where this could be applied and have proposed a middle housing geography in the city, probably about twice as large as the minimum set by the state, where middle housing would be allowed on all lots that currently allow residential development. So any lot that today allows a single family home would allow duplexes, triplexes, or fourplexes. So that's what has been proposed, and this is going to Planning Commission for a study session in 2 weeks. It would be great to have a letter from the Commission for Plan Development if you guys would like to submit a letter. I'll just mention that because in the packet, the recommendations to Mayor and Council several years ago in 2022, one of those was for zoning regulations, changes for zoning regulations to encourage more affordable housing. And I think a major milestone was earlier this year when the community board works tool was adopted by Mayor and Council. That really, a lot of that came from a recommendation from the Commission on Equitable Housing and Development that we look at those zoning regulations. So that made a huge change in terms of the zoning regulations on our corridors and has incentives for affordable housing. And this is more geared towards the residential areas of the city and facilitating more affordable housing and more housing options in those areas. We did hear a lot of interest in allowing this citywide. So I think we see this as a first step and that in, you know, a year or 2 years, we would evaluate what has been the impact of this. How can we scale this up across the city? So that's definitely in our plan.
And if you didn't see, there is a draft letter already that was.
My comment is I support this. I wondered when I spread about this, what the legislature did to limit it to within an hour of the central business district seemed way too limited. I definitely support anything to increase housing density. That's what this does. It's a major pushback from neighborhoods. We don't want to have a fourplex next to their single-family residence.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to work, but I definitely support it.
I was at a lot of the working group meetings, and over 60% of residents were supportive of it being as flexible as possible or citywide. So the majority, there were vocal loud members of communities, but the majority of respondents did say that they would rather see it citywide or as flexible as possible.
Does anybody have a sense of what that opposition would actually look like and how strong it would be? If, you know, I know 40% is a decent number, and, you know,
it was more around 30-something percent. And what you did get in the in-person meeting especially was a vocal group of a few individuals, but then the majority still within that meeting and all the polls and all the things happening in that meeting being very in support of as flexible as possible.
So I think as a homeowner in a historic neighborhood in Tucson, I think people in my neighborhood would freak out if they knew about this, because if too many houses don't meet the character, the whole neighborhood could lose historic status, which essentially doubles the property taxes for anybody who currently has historic status. So there's real money on the table for historic neighborhoods. And so like in Winter Haven, we have a height limit of 16 feet something. So everybody, when you buy a house, you have to sign that you're going to abide by all of the bylaws and CCNRs and the homeowners association. And you know, I don't know how that plays into it. If there are homeowners association rules and regulations, we're saying that this middle housing also has to meet those, because that's gonna, because I one of the things that's in our bylaws and CCNRs is you can't have more than one house on the property.
Right. So great question, CCNRs, and also touch on historic. So this does not override CCNRs. CCNRs are actually private agreements that zoning cannot override. So if you have in a neighborhood a height limit or only one house per lot, you know, if all the property owners have agreed to that, that's essentially a covenant, restrictive covenant between all those homeowners. Okay. So this would not override that. In terms of historic neighborhoods, any neighborhood that is a city-designated historic neighborhood, a historic preservation zone, which we have 5 of in the city, they would still need to meet the historic preservation standards, the design standards for that neighborhood, and go through a design process. But it would mean that, you know, you can do a duplex on your lot if you're in Armory Park, but you have to go through the design process and comply with the historic design standards just like you do today. What's interesting is a lot of this middle housing is most prevalent in our historic neighborhoods, because those predate a lot of the zoning that started to make it more difficult to build duplexes and triplexes. So you walk around Armory Park, you see duplexes, triplexes, small apartment buildings even that are just kind of blended in with single family homes. So but in historic National Register neighborhoods, like you're talking about, Jim, those are areas we don't have zoning protection. It's a voluntary thing that those neighborhoods have done. And you're right, it does have a property tax benefit. So it's really then up to the homeowners to choose if they want to retain that property tax benefit by preserving the historic character of those homes. So that's the kind of how it impacts historic.
And one thing I think that is important to understand is that none of the middle housing code is different from what applies to a residence. So if your neighbor can expand, your neighbor can already expand their house, but they're within the parameters. So this would just allow for some flexibility in some neighborhoods to do the same thing that's already allowed on a lot with some added flexibility.
Yeah, so we are proposing to add some zoning flexibility in terms of setbacks, to make it easier to utilize the lot on units, but there's no changes to height limit, which would still be 2 stories, but what it is pretty much across the city in our single family residential neighborhoods. And so something Logan said is one thing in this bill is that it says you cannot regulate middle housing any differently than you regulate single family housing. They have to be the same regulations. So we're actually, since these could now be 3 and 4 units on a lot, which today we actually have commercial multifamily standards. If you're doing 4 units, you have to have landscaping and things like that. So we didn't want to lose some of those requirements that actually are really important to providing more open space for residents, more landscaping for neighborhoods. So we're actually, in some ways, going to be raising the bar on all single family homes in the city, because we are proposing landscape standards for the first time for single family homes. So this would require tree planting based on the number of units on your lot, and that will apply to middle family as well as single family homes.
So is this
wow?
Is this going to fall under the IEC or the IRC?
Great question. So we also are proposing to amend our building code to allow up to 4 units to use the International Residential Building Code, and that has actually already been endorsed by our building code committee. So that will go to mayor and council when we bring these zoning changes. That allows much more efficient construction methods.
Yeah.
Currently, it's very restrictive once you get to 3 or more units. So this will allow those 3 and 4 unit buildings to use the International Residential Code. And we reviewed this with our fire department. They're very comfortable. There will be some requirements for egress that are changing a little bit, but they're on board with it. And we got endorsement from our building code committee.
Cool. Is there anything in there that has access to transit as a component of this?
So, yes, there's actually a provision, actually Amanda maybe knows best. I think initially we were basing the parking requirement off of access to transit, but I think we've maybe done away with that at this point. Amanda, you can
pick
up on that.
So the parking rules are not exactly changing from what's currently on code, which is 1 required off-street, off-site spot per unit. However, if it is located within 1/4 mile of a public transit route or a enhanced bike route, then they will be able to waive that parking requirement. And we are also looking at considering if they are, if they do not have a curb cut currently and they are not putting one in, then we might waive it in that case as well. That is something that we're currently looking at based on the recent feedback we received. And those rules, the quarter mile from public transit and from enhanced bike routes, is similar to what we had for ADUs when we passed those code amendments in 2016.
Yeah.
And enhanced bike route? Those
I'm sorry?
Bike, all over Tucson? What's an enhanced bike route? I don't know what that means.
Enhanced bike routes are like they're mainly along major streets, also like Treat, maybe Pima, Third, and others. It's a designation from DTM. It's not all streets that are labeled as enhanced bike routes. And I can get this specific and follow up with whomever's the coordinator for this. I think it's Rachel.
You know all those new crosswalk lights they've added all over the city? Those are for the enhanced bike routes.
Yeah.
So there's corridors now designated. They're not on our major arterials, but they're like halfway between them. That sort of like,
yeah, I understand what that is because I use them all the time.
Oh,
I just don't know if that's what they meant.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what we mean. Like Third, Treat, Mountain.
Yeah, I ride in Third and Treat to get to work every day.
Yeah.
Awesome. So a quarter mile from those, no additional parking would be required. That's also going above and beyond the state requirement. And based on the geography, I think like almost every lot would fall into that category.
Right, people can walk or ride a bike a quarter mile.
Yeah, and it means less of the site is dedicated to parking, more of the site for housing, hopefully,
right,
or open space.
I just want to direct to the chat too. It looks like Megan, I allowed Megan to speak if she wants to speak on her comment too.
Thank you. Is it okay if I talk? No, I'm not on the commission. I'll take this. Silence is yes. Okay, sorry. I had a clarifying question based on what Jim was stating. So, well, elaborate on that a little bit more. Like a situation like Winter Haven, is this, because those are all developed lots, it hadn't occurred to me, but does that mean that someone would by right be able to remove the existing property and put up a new structure is what's saying, but clearly not correct because of the CCNRs are in place. Is that
right?
True?
There's no prohibition on demolishing an existing structure.
Okay. And then separately, so based on, do we know what portion of the proposed area that would allow this middle housing have CCNRs in place that might be restrictive?
It's a great question. Amanda, I don't know if we've looked at that.
We haven't looked at CCNRs that would restrict middle housing within the proposed middle housing area. I do want to clarify that the boundaries of the proposed middle housing area currently do not include Winter Haven. It goes over to Country Club, but then turns to at Fort Lowell. And I believe Winter Haven is north of Fort Lowell, correct? So Winter Haven specifically would not be part of the middle housing area at first, though, like Corin mentioned, we are exploring going citywide in future phases.
I also wonder, you know, how much change and how many, you know, fourplexes would need to be built in a historic neighborhood before all of a sudden it would not really qualify or not meet the requirements. And it often seems like there's fear about that, but the idea that that would happen it would be so challenging to make that happen that it's almost not an issue. But
I have permitted and regulated permit in historic neighborhoods, and the design guidelines would make it nearly impossible to remove a building from contributing status. And it would make it nearly impossible to make a building that's not compliant with the character of the neighborhood. That ends up being a hurdle towards developing housing, but it does end up preserving the neighborhoods in all my experience working in Army Park, Barrio, NPZs like Feldman's and Jefferson Park.
So the idea that this would jeopardize a neighborhood's historic designation is very remote.
It means that, well, what happens is you would submit, and then as part of your permit review, it would trigger a review of historic compliance with the HPZ, the NPZ, the CCNRs.
Yeah, I think the concern is national register districts like Winter Haven that are not locally designated.
Oh, okay.
I will say those neighborhoods, you know, historic regulations actually have done a lot for preservation of neighborhoods. And I think those neighborhoods tend to have very well cared for homes that are less likely to, I think you could see expansion And I think there's actually a lot of ways to expand and keep your historic designation if you are attentive to that, you know, in the rear of the primary structure and things like that. So actually, that's something that I think would be really interesting to see if there's guidance from SHPO over the next few years, as so many jurisdictions have to adopt these regulations, on how to maintain your contributing status if you want to add even a duplex in the rear of your primary home. I mean, I think there's ways to do that.
I was just going to say, you were talking earlier about sort of the 60% were in favor. I've seen this a lot, and people are in favor until it's their neighborhood. It's fine if it's somewhere else. And I think the big issue that's come up time and time again, and I've dealt with this in the past, sometimes it's parking, but more often than not, it's density. It's that suddenly we're going to have way more people on the road when I'm trying to go to work every day. And I think that density thing really frightens people. I think what you talked about preserving the look of the neighborhood, the trees, those are really important because people envision this massive, you know, apartment complexes up and down the street. So I think a lot of it has to do with getting ahead of the messaging. But I do think if you have 60% in favor now, that's good. But there's going to be backlash because I've seen it in every community. But then when it's happened, I've also seen communities go, oh, actually, it's just fine because the building is beautiful and it's not a problem. But
I would say that having been part of the advocacy for ADUs and then now this, and working with planning and development as just a citizen, ADUs, there was a lot of objection. And then what we see in the city of Tucson is the viability of building an ADU is not entirely there.
Right.
Majority of the units that we've permitted or looked at have been built for senior housing or people to build housing for their parents. It doesn't pan out to rent it immediately because we're not at that high stress of a development situation like San Diego is, where you do see a historic house bulldozed, and that's because they didn't build a supply of housing for so long that the pressure was high enough that the viability of tearing down the house and building four was there. If we can get on top of this, then we can allow for more flexibility, which will then allow us to take a lower, slower approach aligned with SHPO. And that's like from, it costs for a 650 square foot unit, it's around $200,000. And so the mortgage at the current interest rates means you're going to be at $1,500 to $2,000 a month. So that's higher than the median rental income. So we're not seeing a fast rollout of anything, which means ADUs, I've not heard a negative comment after it was passed. So I think, like you're saying, like once it's done, the impact is much less than we're terrified of. And so, so the messaging.
It's just like, I think what you've done, I'm really impressed because I think you've hit on a lot of the things that people get afraid of. I'm just saying, I'm a bit of a cynic who's been there, done that, and everybody loves it until it's their neighborhood. And so I think it's, again, just about communication and all of those pieces, which sounds like you're doing a good job.
Thanks for this proposal and for the draft letter. I think it looks really good. I would love to have HC support it. The one question I had about it, you mentioned that there would be new regulation for single-family residential homes. Could you explain more about that?
Yeah, so because the standards have to be basically the thing, we can't over-regulate or regulate middle housing to a higher standard than single family. That's what the bill says. So there will be, we're proposing a new requirement for single family homes to provide landscaping. This is very common in a lot of other cities, and we haven't had a requirement in Tucson. I will say almost every, well, the majority of homes built in Tucson do have that requirement because they're part of a subdivision. Most of the homes that we permit are model plans in larger subdivisions where there are landscape requirements. But a one-off home in the middle of the city on a lot, a vacant lot, you build just one home, there's no requirements for landscaping. That's where now there will be a requirement that you have a tree or two, you know, depending on the size of your home. So that's what's new. That's about 10 to 15% of our housing production compared to your single family in subdivisions that already have requirements like that. So a small impact, but hopefully, you know, I think it will make an impact in terms of meeting our climate goals. You know, we have a lot of neighborhoods that have very low tree canopies, so that's also what we're looking at, as well as just the aesthetics of a neighborhood.
So it just requires landscaping at the time you're getting permits to build. It doesn't require you watering your plants. Or
we hope people water. We do have some requirements.
If he dies, replacing it.
Yeah.
So no one can do that.
Well, there would be enforcement just like we enforce based on complaints, landscaping standards, like weeds in your front yard. It would be similar to that if there was an issue.
Mm-hmm. But are there any unintended consequences for particularly neighborhoods like you mentioned, Feldman's, near the university, and mm-hmm. is encouraging more student housing in neighborhoods and the pushback around that? I'm just curious.
Yeah, we have heard that concern from those neighborhoods. So a lot of those neighborhoods do have neighborhood preservation zone standards in place, which is our design standards for Jackson Park, Feldman, and Rincon Heights as well. So they would go through a design review process, but it would allow 40 minutes on a lot of those lots. We have heard, you know, that concern from those neighborhoods, but most of their current protections that are in place would remain in place. There is a change to how we define group dwellings because this basically is going to require a change in our code because we currently have very restrictive limitations in a lot of our R1 neighborhoods that can't have more than 4 unrelated people on a property. So this would change that now that we have 4 units. So we are proposing to relax there as well, which many people have pointed out previously to us, they feel is antiquated. So that will be a change.
So do we need a motion to support this? I made the last one. Do you want to make this? Somebody else want to make it?
I would say based on this letter, this is a pretty mild letter that we could say that just says we support housing flexibility. I think I'd make a motion to support this letter as it is.
Second. All those in favor?
Is Vicky still on? Vicky, did you hear that?
Yes, Vicky's here.
Yeah, I heard it. My issue before was with the amendments and all the back and forth and then not repeating the motion.
I just wanted to make sure that you heard because I didn't know that you were on before. So that being said, I think all those in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. All those opposed? Any abstentions? Okay. The motion passes.
Thank you all, and we'll keep you updated on the actual planning commission public hearing. This next meeting is a study session, so we'll provide this to planning commission, and then when there's opportunity for public hearing, we'll let you know.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I also have to leave a little early. Thank you all.
All right, y'all. Now what we actually came here for today, we're going to get into, obviously we needed to talk about those things quite a bit more. So, basically, the next item on the agenda is going back to present and discuss the action plans that we've come up with our subcommittees. And what we were going to do today is we were going to have SDR, we're going to have Brian facilitate this conversation, but he got COVID, so he's not able to be here today, obviously, which, you know, I think has turned out to be just fine since we've spent so much time on the other agenda items. So let's see, I actually have the facilitator who knows here. Let's see. So just to set up the conversation, obviously, as a group, we decided, you know, at the beginning of this year that we really wanted to focus on addressing homelessness and, you know, really focus our energy there. In our subcommittees, we've been working on different aspects of homelessness and the ideas that we would come up with recommendations for mayor and council around homelessness prevention and other aspects. See, at this point, I think the best idea would be for us to basically report out what we did in our subcommittees. I know that Tisha's subcommittee really hasn't been able to meet, and what she told me was that basically she thinks what they probably would have recommended was essentially sanctioned encampments, which if you're unaware, the city of Tucson has a pilot around that. So that's kind of happening. So really, I'm just putting that out there, but also just to say that really we've got two subcommittees that have been dealing with this. In your packets, you've got the recommendations
So basically, why don't we take a few minutes to do a report out of what we came up with in our subcommittees? And Jim, would you be willing to kick it off and go over what you guys came up with in your?
Sure, I'm going to kick it over to Maggie.
Oh, God.
He's teasing.
Sure. So this is the one that we came up with, one of the housing spectrum under the objectives. It's printed on landscape. So I don't know if we just want to read this.
Yeah, do we just take a few minutes to look it over? And do you guys,
I mean, I can kind of talk it through. Basically, the objectives that we said is that we want to, that we think that we need to accomplish are we want to reduce the incidence of people who are entering homelessness, create living situations for people who are experiencing homelessness who have mental illness and substance abuse conditions. So it's kind of like the housing first model. But it's important that there are services that go along with the housing that can help these individuals get through whatever challenges they're facing. Want to reduce the financial burden on owners who have property who rent to individuals with known mental or behavioral issues. We talked about updating the zoning code to allow for the acquisition of existing buildings and the construction of new buildings for sheltering homeless individuals. So basically where that came from was there was a presentation done that showed if there's a homeless shelter that falls under high occupancy and there's only a handful, like 5 or 10 locations in the entire city that have the zoning to build a shelter. And it's practically speaking impossible to go through a rezoning for a homeless shelter. So the only real solution is to update the code to make it easier to develop shelters. And then the last objective was to identify additional sources to boost the supply. So the desired outcomes are basically very similar, obviously, to our objectives. We want to increase the funding for homelessness prevention assistance with required services, which we did today. Good job, everybody. Create a new brand of communities with private quarters that is focused specifically on recovering from mental illness and substance abuse for no less than 30 days and up to 150 days. Where this one came from was currently, if somebody overdoses, the state legally can't hold them for more than 72 hours or 48 hours? I think it's 48 hours.
Yes.
48 hours?
Very little. 48.
And at that point, they're not still really not in the position where they can make an intelligent decision on what's best for their future. There needs to be more time for them to come off of whatever they're on in order for them to really make a decision on if they would help or not. And so what's happening is these people are being brought in, they're being saved, and then they're being pushed right back at the street. And so it takes time. It can take up to 6 months, really, to kind of help them get through some of the addictions and things that they're dealing with. So there needs to be places that are really set up to handle those types of intense, difficult situations.
This question about that, and that would be a consensual. It would be like that they could stay there. But
yeah, like, we're not putting them in jail. That's not what I'm talking about. But
there are other proposals that have said that. I mean, that's terrifying. They would have the option of.
Yeah. No. Well. More. So.
I like them.
I
know. I'm sorry, but I have a son who has struggled with addiction, and that's one of the things. I'm like, you can never force them to do anything. He's in recovery. Thank God. But I'm like, Surely we gotta get him in somewhere where he can detox. Right. Exactly what you just said.
So
now, where are you from?
I was on the committee that put this together. And this piece of it was because if you go into the Pima County treatment center, other treatment centers, you know, people are going into the center and then they're deciding they don't want to stay. So they're let go, or they are let go for whatever reason. This is if you want to have some housing in a communal setting, then you will go through treatment, and that's your choice. Not your choice about going through treatment if you live here, but your choice if you want to move in here. Because this is the parameter.
I think I understand, though, that part of that issue, and I don't know what it requires, is that it's a fair housing issue.
But it's not, so this is why it's temporary.
Yeah.
And it's a communal setting. So you're going to be able to be housed here in your own space.
You're on your own. Yeah.
And, yeah. But it's a communal setting for people who want to recover from whatever it is that they need to recover from. So if you want to live here, this is what will happen. And you need to participate. And then you have a choice whether you want to be here or not, you know.
Great. Thank you for clarification.
Okay. Okay, so we would also want to remove barriers. Remove barriers in order to allow available sources to assist individuals with mental illness and other severe issues. yeah, so right now, in order to get into a lot of facilities, you have to be sober to get admitted. And then we talked about the zoning item already. So in terms of tasks,
Jim, I think that this one was when we were talking in the group. If Access or DES or us, some other money that's specified for people with mental illness or substance abuse, they are requiring that the owners of these properties have to take these certain individuals. I think what was meant by this was that we want those fund sources to reduce those requirements and take them off the table, because those requirements are a barrier to the owner. It's cost related,
right.
Their behaviors. Yeah. And they should be able to determine, because they've put money in the deal, who lives there.
Right. So it's the sources that are driving that, not the facilities.
So it's a little bit different of a wording on this.
Yeah. Okay. So in terms of the tasks, we didn't put Gates as responsible in all of these. So the first one was, we'd like to see an increase in the number of emergency shelter beds. Based on the point in time count, which is the published, I thought this month. Did that get published?
It's not published. Like the 2025 point in time count.
Has it already been published?
A couple of months ago.
It was already published.
Yeah.
Okay.
Numbers for it.
Okay. So, review the housing needs assessment that's currently being done by ECO Northwest. Determine the best uses of the funds. Identify zoning amendments that need to allow that can provide flexibility for the shelters. Identify zoning means to allow for more affordable housing to be built in more locations. Create a functionalized centralized database and coordinate an entry to track homelessness and services. This is the thing that we've been talking about with PPCH. Identify a permanent annual source to fund the City of Tucson Housing Trust Fund. Put that on the city manager. I'm sure Liz will be happy about that. establish a PR campaign to educate the public about these issues. So, information needs, point in time count, the Eco Northwest Housing Supply Study. We want to see Pima County's Affordable Housing Fund's final proposal, including sources and uses. So, Pima County has committed $250 million to affordable housing over the next 10 years, which is a substantial amount. I don't know if anybody else in the state that's doing anywhere close to that. So we'd like to see how they're planning on not only sourcing it, but what their priorities are in terms of how that money is spent. Look at our current standards versus best practices for some of the zoning requirements. So the obstacles are CX Tucson has a funding gap, which we're all aware of. The overwhelming complexity of this problem makes it difficult to know where to start. And I think that's part of what we've all been struggling with, is because this is there is no one size fits all solution to addressing the homeless situation. So it makes it difficult to address it comprehensively and to bring together all the resources necessary. And at least I think, and we fall into this category, feeling overwhelmed to the point where we become indifferent to the issues instead of taking action. And that one is kind of where that education component came from, is, you know, there's a lot of people who say, well, just do this or just do that. And you can't just do one thing and solve this. It's too complicated. One of the obstacles is, how do you help people who don't want help? And we've talked about that previously. And the availability of existing suitable sites. So I think the opportunities is Pima County is showing great leadership right now in their funding commitments. And this corridor overlay, which was just passed, has received a ton of community support. And I think it's a good step in that direction. That's what we came up with.
I have one comment. Since the committee is sending a letter about the Housing Trust Fund to City Council, there's a task in here that, you know, asking the city manager to fund the trust fund $2 to $10 million annually. I'm wondering if that can be put in that letter. You wanted something strong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's imperative that the city identify a permanent annual source of it from anywhere from $2 to $10 million annually. If that could be added to that letter, I think that's a good thing.
I did have a question related to that. Where did the number come from? Is it based on?
This was something that was actually come up. We came up with in a previous recommendation from. Actually, I think it's. I saw the letter in this list, and then okay. If you go back to our previous, our last recommendation, that was the last recommendation to Mayor and Council. So we're repeating to them what we've already asked.
So let's just repeat it, and it repeats it for a third time, and then second time, and I think it makes sense.
Yeah. If we want to do that, it might not be a bad idea to make a motion to add that to the letter, right? I mean, that too.
Yeah.
So moved.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Any discussion about, so basically the motion is that we want to add to the letter to Mayor and Council regarding the Housing Trust Fund, that the recommendation is $2 to $10 million per year to go through the Housing Trust Fund, correct?
I do support it, and I'm also curious what Nicole might have to share with the sources.
Nicole, did you hear the question?
I did. Thank you, everyone. I was just saying I could just generally touch upon the buckets or the general strategies that we're talking about funding with the $250 million. Does that make sense to do right now?
Oh, well, we're still on this motion, right?
What was your question?
Go for it.
I thought that might have something to do with the 2 to 10, you know.
No, like, it's separate.
It doesn't.
That's the county. We're talking about the city.
Okay. So I think we've got the
motion and the second, correct? Is there any further discussion about adding this to the letter? All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, the motion passes. Where are we?
I just have a couple of comments on what Jim was just saying. I think that maybe I understood from what Nicole just said on the Pima County's affordable housing funds, this $250 million over 10 years. I thought that was a proposal stage, and it sounds like it's been approved. I didn't know that. So, Daniel?
Yeah. Why don't we have close? Nicole, you want to weigh in now about the $250 million? I do also want to do a time check. So, you know, we're going to get out of here at 6 o'clock. So, Nicole, if you could keep it relatively brief, and then I will go over our recommendations very quickly. And then what I would finally like to do is just get an idea of what we want to do for next meeting, because I don't think we're at the place where we can approve the recommendations for mayor and council. So with that being said, go ahead, Nicole.
Sure. Thank you very much. So the $250 million funding policy, you know, has been approved. So $250 million over 10 years. We don't know how the cash flow is going to work out yet. But we're working with our housing commission and Echo Northwest, who's the consultant that helped us with the housing needs assessment study, to develop the housing strategy and funding plan. So we should have that in draft form by December. And that will show how we envision those funds being spent. And generally, we're looking at part of it for development, so continuing to use the gap funding that, for example, the city uses to draw down on the LIHTC funds, and preservation. And then on the keeping people housed side, because our board has sort of divided up these funds into development and keeping people housed, we're looking at home repair and weatherization, eviction prevention, so expanding our EELS program, emergency rental and utility assistance, and then some form of rapid rehousing that is not under the federal constraints of that. But those are the pots that we're generally looking at. And the funding plan, we envision it will be the $250 million plus the federal funds that the county also gets for those types of activities. And we've started to have conversations with city staff about whether we can also fold in just what does the city anticipate in those areas spending over the next 10 years, so it can really be a truly regional plan and reflect all of those together.
One more comment before we move on Jim's presentation. The number two obstacles, the overwhelming complexity. Homelessness is an overwhelming problem, and I don't think we should ever commit to solving homelessness. We can't do that. What we have a commitment to do is to do something about it. That's where our commitment is.
Mm-hmm.
Good point.
Yeah.
If I can also, point number three, how do you help people who don't want help? I would ask that we actually change that. There is a common myth and misperception that their people are service resistant and don't want help. That has largely been proven to be untrue. What the fact is we don't have what they're looking for. So for example, when we moved away from congregate shelters to like hotel rooms, we had almost 100% compliance from people saying, yes, I'll move inside. Mm-hmm. So if we could just rephrase that to something that says more, how do we ensure we have options to support different needs or something? Because that to me just perpetuates this idea that people are out there resisting help.
Yeah, I actually thought this came up. I don't remember the final version of it. So I think it's a really small number of groups. There might be people that simply don't want help, but it's very rare.
It's very small. Well, they have extreme mental illness and they don't, you know, but I think this is just such a common myth that we hear all the time, and I don't want us to perpetuate.
It should be deleted.
Yeah, I agree. We talked about that. For some reason, I thought it was off. I was a little surprised it was still on there, so I'm sorry.
Thank you. I appreciate that, because I dealt with that for so many years.
Again, we've got 9 minutes. What I'd like to do is just go very quickly over a summary of recommendations from our group, and then maybe I'll just go ahead and give the feedback now. But to me, what it seems like is it wasn't actually a bad idea, a bad thing that Brian couldn't be here today to help facilitate, because I think maybe next time, the next meeting, the facilitation could really help us, because, you know, obviously our recommendations and Jim's group's recommendations, they need to be worked up into like an actual document. And I think, you know, determining what goes in that document and kind of how we get there could be helpful in terms of the facilitation next time. Does that sound like a reasonable thing to do for our next meeting, or what else do we want to do in terms of getting this to the finish line in terms of a, you know, having a document that we can provide to Mayor and Council with our recommendations? Any thoughts?
I volunteer Tisha.
Too late to write the document. All in favor? Any other thoughts, or does that sound like a good plan? I'm certainly open to ideas, but
it does. We can't finish what we have to do today, obviously.
No, and I think the facilitation will help us get there.
We'll be in person then, the next meeting?
It's not supposed to be, but we could always.
Is the facilitator preferred in person?
What's that?
The facilitator prefers in person?
I just think it's better. Yeah, yes, he does, actually. He did say that. I think it is better to have facilitation in person. So we could definitely decide to have the next meeting in person as well.
I like having person.
Let me guarantee it's going to be a nice cool day the way my butterfly was today.
For sure.
We have to ask Tisha to rehab access to the
room.
Or if not, maybe at HCD.
Yeah, getting a room seemed pretty easy so far. Yeah. So. Well, do we all want to at least tentatively agree to meet in person next month as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. When's the next meeting?
That's a good question.
Thursday, October 2nd.
Thursday, October 2nd. All right. So we will. We've agreed that we want to meet in person next meeting as well. I'll talk to Brian and HCD and company about having the facilitation for next time. Any other details, logistics, other things before I go through our summary real quick and get us out of here? Okay. So basically, in our subcommittee, we were looking at homelessness prevention. And, you know, as I've talked about numerous times, we grounded our recommendations essentially in Pete Bentley's presentation about homelessness prevention, which everybody's had an opportunity to see at this point. But, you know, he's got really great evidence. It's really well researched. And the other reason we basically just took his recommendations as they were is, one, he was very happy to have that happen because he's very much wanting his research and work to be practical and have impact. And also just in our research of what other communities were doing and just generally what good practices are in terms of homelessness prevention, we saw a lot of this stuff repeated. So that's why, you know, we took it and have given Keith credit here. So a lot of this we've talked about, so I'm not gonna go into great depth, but obviously, like we talked about over and over, there's just a lack of a coordinated system with what services are out there, who's got what, you know, nobody seems to know from one week to the next. So, you know, collaborating to get a coordinated system together. The second one is access to information. It's kind of goes with this, right? Again, just people have a hard time finding the accurate information about what's out there. So, you know, having a more centralized, accessible repository with updates and, you know, obviously somebody that's or some group that's keeping up with that, expanding housing stability navigators, and creating a no wrong door referral system. The next issue is resource shortages and eligibility barriers. Current supports are under-resourced and exclude many households, and the recommendation is to provide realistic information of a likelihood of service, expand supportive diversion options like home sharing or community housing, and again, more navigators and emergency housing programs. Another issue that we identified, exits from institutions. We've talked about this today as well. You know, people coming out of various institutions and basically going in directly into homelessness. And the recommendation here is to implement better screening, exit planning, and reentry supports with housing stability navigators assigned to high-risk individuals.
This one for me is low-hanging fruit. We know who those people are, and we need to do something. So having this happen.
Right.
It's just in our face.
Yep. The next one is underfunding. I mean, what else do we need to say? There's just not enough funding to do what we know we need to do. There are diverse needs, right? And again, this, we were just talking about this, right? This idea that some people are resistant. It's really more the needs of folks are not being met. So, you know, the recommendation here is to design diverse data-driven prevention strategies that respond to these needs. Then the final one is a shortage of affordable housing, right? This all comes back to this being a housing issue. So prevention efforts are limited by, are hindered by limited affordable housing. And the recommendation, no big surprise here, invest in affordable housing. So that's where we got to. It's 5:57. I think, I mean, obviously we can take a couple of questions real quick, but I think maybe what we can do is just review these again before the next meeting. Obviously we'll have time to think about them, and next meeting we will center going over these again, having facilitation, and working to the point of, you know, getting this, these together and recommendations that can easily be put into a document for mayor and council. Any questions or comments real quick?
So there's a draft letter to go to mayor and council, which we came done, what to do with housing trust fund money. Are we going to see the letter that is going to be actually sent?
Yeah, we need to all agree up on, I think, what the contents of that are, which drafted. I think
there's a little bit of talking about the housing trust fund letter.
Yes.
Oh, the one we were talking about.
Yeah, so that letter that we have a draft of and we changed today, is the, so when there's a final draft of it ready to be sent, are we going to see that? I'm not sure about approving it.
For sure.
If we've approved it, I just want to see it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we can send it up.
For sure.
For sure. Before finalizing, it'll definitely go to Jay for kind of check mark. But yeah, then we can send it out for the whole thing for sure.
Any other questions, comments?
I just wanted to quick comment. We didn't get have time to go over this today, but I'm passing it out just so because we did it, so you have it. But so just to absorb before next month. If you're kind of thinking about what, you know, recommendations and how the previous recommendations went, we kind of had a conversation in some of our planning meetings about, you know, how the commission's recommendations in 2022 were then acted upon by mayor and council. We kind of went through and detailed kind of the actions taken by the city and mayor and council over the past, you know, 3.5-ish years. So, yeah, just wanted to make sure we have
that. Just to wrap up the meeting now, one of the things that we were going to talk about today, if we had time, which we didn't, which we need to, is after we get our recommendations together regarding homelessness and get that to mayor and council, what are we doing next? What do we want to focus on a single issue? Do we want to kind of open back up and go broad again? And I think the facilitators can help us with that at our next meeting as well. So maybe we'll have that be a little bit more time. Obviously, it was kind of a primer to be thinking about it. And then next steps, the dates of the next subcommittees are on here and the next commission meeting. Obviously, we agreed to meet in person next time. Again, the next Pima County Housing Commission meeting is on here as well. And I think that's it. Is there anything else, any other questions or comments before we adjourn?
With a question as a newbie, I'd love to volunteer on committees, so I'm not sure how.
Yes.
Yeah.
We need members on our subcommittees.
Okay, so I just look through and
we will coordinate that and get some emails out early.
Okay. So right now do we have actually two committees?
We've got the housing trust fund, and then the mobile home.
We
just
I'm sorry.
We're as part of it.
Motion to adjourn.
We're adjourned. Good job.